Welcome to Let's Finally Watch This, a podcast for casual movie fans who've always meant to watch classic movies. I'm your host, Nick Hayden.
And I am your other host, Timothy Deal.
And we are in 1934.
We're back in the 30s, Nick.
All right. I like the 30s.
Yeah.
Well, last season, whatever.
We've had an interesting variety of stuff.
First season, we had Marx Brothers in 32.
32. Very zany comedy.
Great. We loved it. Swordfish. In 1933, we had 42nd Street, which I think was on the bottom of our list last season.
For last season, yeah. But it was a musical, gritty musical.
Apparently really important, I guess, with certain musical people.
I guess so. But this time we have got something very different.
We have
It Happened One Night.
Directed by
Frank Capra.
Yes, which if you don't know the name, he's most famous for It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life, and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Exactly.
Those are probably his two most famous movies. Even people who aren't big classic movie fans
know one of those two, at least.
Have probably heard one of those two.
Yeah.
But there's a lot, and we can talk more about Frank Capra as we get into this.
So, but give us a quick summary of what's happening movie-wise in the 30s.
Okay, let's do a quick review. We've talked in the last two seasons about four main things to know about movies in the 30s. I'm going to kind of rearrange the order here for purposes of today's movie.
Okay.
But first, so of course, the Great Depression is going on. That's going to have a big effect on theater attendance.
I mean, it does show up in today's movie. Everyone's always looking for money, except for...
Yeah, they're always kind of looking for money. It's subtle, like a lot more pickpockets around, it would seem.
Yeah.
The studio system is in effect now. That tends to overlap with Hollywood's golden age, which is usually said to begin with the sound era in 1927.
What studio was this?
This studio is one of the three minor studios. This is Columbia Pictures.
Okay.
So there were five major studios who controlled everything, and then three minor studios. And then there's also this thing called Poverty Row, which would make all the B movies, basically.
Oh, okay. Fun.
The really cheapy stuff. But Columbia Pictures, they were kind of near, some people have called them near Poverty Row, but this movie was such a success. And actually, and also thanks to Frank Capra in general, he was on contract for Columbia Pictures.
Okay.
And he really elevated them to establish them as one of the minors.
Okay.
The little three of the studio system.
So did he do all of his movies Columbia? Do you know?
He did through the late 30s. And then at some point they did something that made him mad, and he started making some movies for Warner Brothers.
Okay.
So I don't have that date right in front of me. But Frank Capra was the director that really elevated that studio. Till now it's owned by Sony and makes Spider-Man movies.
Yeah, there you go.
So, you know you've hit your peak when you've make superhero movies. But this is also, of course, the era of talkies. Music and fast-paced dialogue are big sellers for your movies. And this year, in 1934 specifically, midway through this year, I think in the end of June, beginning of July, is when the Hays Code starts being more rigorously enforced.
Which remind us what the Hays Code is for those who don't know it all.
Yeah, the Hays Code, or the Motion Picture Production Code, was basically a way for the studios to self-regulate, trying to minimize the amount of scandalous content, violence.
Violence, sexual content.
Sexual content, critiquing authority too much.
Yep.
Basically something that the Catholics organizations were really pushing for Hollywood to do, and they would rather self-regulate than let the government regulate them. So that midway through this year, but this movie, It Happened One Night, came out in the beginning, like February of this year. So it's still technically considered a pre-code film, even though the code is technically around, it hasn't really been enforced until July 1st of this year.
We were trying to figure out, maybe we'll mention again, how much would the Hays Code affect it or not, because it's kind of...
Yeah,
implies some things.
Yeah, it teeters on the line.
It's not scandalous, but it's for the culture maybe at the time.
Yeah, maybe. I know. I'm not a historian, so I wouldn't know for sure. But we'll talk about that. So those are the kind of the four big things to remember about the 30s. Just touching on 1934 in particular here, the top grossing film of the year was Kid Millions, which was an Eddie Cantor comedy. The big Oscar winner this year was actually this movie, It Happened One Night. A big Oscar winner. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. Some other notable things for this year. On April 19th, Fox Studios releases Stand Up and Cheer, which features Shirley Temple's breakout role.
Okay.
By the end of this year, she would star in four feature films.
Wow.
Like, because they realized they had a gold mine on their hand, including by the end of the year, December 11th, the film Bright Eyes, in which Shirley Temple sings one of her trademark songs. songs on the Good Ship Lollipop.
Okay.
So that is this year in 1934. Just looking over kind of the Hays Code or the Production Code Administration thing being established in the summer. Yeah. That's kind of the other big thing from this year. Some notable film debuts that happened in 1934. Gene Autry, Alec Guinness, Rita Hayworth, Rosalind Russell, George Sanders, Ann Ruthard, and one notable character, Donald Duck, makes his appearance for the first time this year, 1934, in the film The Wise Little Hen.
Oh, nice.
So happy 90th birthday, Donald.
Wow, yeah. All right, then. So this movie's directed by Frank Capra. Do you have a little bit about him for those who may not know?
I think we can talk more about Frank Capra as we get into the movie discussion.
Okay.
I will say that this is kind of, again, Frank Capra really elevated Columbia Pictures, I think. He got his start in films in the late 1910s, but it was in the 20s he started kind of learning his style. And I think even after this is really where the movies he starts getting best known for. I think the year after this was Mr. Deeds Comes to Town.
Okay. Which I've heard of.
And would help establish kind of the Capra...
Capra-esque
sort of stuff. I mean, there's some of that here. I mean, this is a classic for sure.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the single character who's kind of a righteous figure and confronting the greed of the rest of the world, that would come a little bit after this one.
Okay. All right. So give us a quick rundown of the summary.
All right. It happened one night. This starts off, we see a character named Ellie Andrews, whose father is very upset with her for going and eloping, or at least getting their marriage and what do they call
the,
it? Declared that they had gone to a courthouse.
It's legally a marriage, but not there'd been no ceremony. They hardly even see each other.
Because basically she has been kind of, she's a sequestered heiress all her life.
Yeah, she's kind of on her bodyguards and her dad runs her life.
Pretty much. And so I think she just wound up getting engaged to the first man who paid her any attention she had, and her father doesn't like it. But she escapes from him and basically he sicks all his detective agencies against her trying to track her down. She winds up hiding on a bus trying to get to New York. A bus that also contains our secondary character, Peter Warren, who is a reporter who has just been fired from his job.
His job, yeah.
Because he's got a boss who's upset at him. But they encounter each other. Peter Warner figures out who Ellie is and how pretty naive she is. She like leaves the bus at one point and is like, just wait, I'm going to be a little bit late. And they're like, oh, yeah? She's like, yes, of course. You just wait. You'll be fine. And of course, Peter knows better. And so he basically helps fund her, since she doesn't really know anything about the outside world, to get to New York, as long as he gets her story. He wants to be able to tell the story about this heiress on her basically big trip from Miami to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they start off as being kind of enemies, but the feelings abound as the journey continues on, as is wants to do in a screwball romantic comedy. And I should note, this is a very early example of what's considered a screwball romantic comedy. The genre is said to begin in film just the year prior, technically, according to historians, in 1933. So this is a very early trend-setting example of 1930s screwball comedies.
And we'll talk a little bit more about how it fits the mold or not, I'm sure, later.
Sure. So, I mean, that's the basically that, just about. Yeah. You can go from there. You can kind of imagine some of the things. Things go wrong.
All kinds of episodes that are very interesting. They meet people.
There's a flat tire. Yeah. They have to abandon the bus. They have to get their own car. There's a famous hitchhiking scene.
Stuff gets robbed from them. They rob things.
Yes. It's a rollicking good road trip slash romantic time.
Yeah. So before we talk about the movie, tell us, how was successful was it? How has it affected future generations?
Well, interestingly, no one expected this to be a big movie. In fact, Clark Gable, who plays Peter Warren, he was basically sent on loan from, he was under contract to MGM, and he was sent to Columbia Pictures basically as a punishment for getting a little too big for his britches. His star was just on the rise before this movie came out, and the success would further cement it, but he was basically sent to a minor studio as punishment for getting...
That backfired.
Yeah, sort of. And his co-star, Claudette Colbert, who I was not familiar with her. I imagine some classic movie fans might be, because she acted in a bunch of movies. Yeah, she starred in more than 60 movies over the years.
Wow.
The only one I had been real familiar with was a comedy called The Egg and I, which introduced Ma and Pa Kettle. But the year after this, she would take the title role in Cleopatra, a Cecil B. DeMille movie. Oh, okay. So, you know, one of there his epics. Mm-hmm. So she was a very popular actress during this period. And she wasn't thrilled about this either, because one of her first acting roles had been with Frank Capra in a 1927 film that didn't do so well.
Okay.
So she was like, I don't want to go Frank. So she named some extravagant price and demands to be in it. And then they hired her anyway. And she's like, dang it. But and when she got done,
everything went wrong. How did we go so right?
Basically, when the filming was done, she told a friend of hers that she just finished the worst picture in the world. And to everyone's surprise, it was a big hit. It didn't start off super great, but like word of mouth kept going and was just in theaters for a long time. And it wound up winning 5 Academy Awards. In fact, it was the first film to win the big 5 Academy Awards: Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Writing. And so far, only 2 other films have actually managed to do that. One, Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975, and The Silence of the Lambs in 1991. I mean, you've got Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, which won 11, but not those 5. It didn't have any acting noms, from what I remember.
So it's interesting, because it sounds like it was also popular with the people.
Yes.
But the Academy loved it too.
Yeah, it's a very unusual. We think of Oscar winners as always being these big artsy things, and this one is just much more... mundane seems like a harsh word for it, but like it's
a normal sort of movie.
Yeah, it really is. It's a romantic comedy. It is what it says on the tin. And I was thinking this week is like, are there really any deep themes? And I don't know that there are in this, but we'll get to that in a minute. But it was notable enough that it has, of course, been entered into the National Film Registry back in 1993. And it is included on several American Film Institute lists, including 100 movies. It was listed at number 35. 100 laughs, 100 comedies is listed at number 8. That's pretty high up there.
Yeah.
4 romances was listed at number 38. When they did their 10th anniversary edition of their 100 movies, it moved from 35 to 46. So it fell back a little bit, but not too bad. And on their 10 top 10 list, when they listed 10 romantic comedies, it is listed as number 3.
Wow. There you go.
There you go. So that was one reason why when we were picking nominations for this year, we were looking at what this one had won. It's like, okay, well, I guess we got to go.
We got to see this. Yeah.
Yeah. Our other nominations for this year, 1934, were Cleopatra with Cecil B. DeMille and The Thin Man, which is a mystery comedy that sparked, was the first of a series of mystery comedies with Nick and Nora. Efron.
Oh,
she's
wow.
She's someone else. But Nick and Nora, it was kind of an uppity husband-wife sleuthing duo.
Okay.
So very comedic, witty dialogue, because that's what you did in the 30s.
Yeah.
And you did some of that in this movie. So you ready to talk about this?
Oh, yes. Set our 12-minute timer, Tim.
You know, this is the first time in years I've ridden piggyback.
This isn't piggyback.
Of course it is.
You're crazy.
I remember distinctly my father taking me for a piggyback ride.
And he carried you like this, I suppose?
Yes.
Your father didn't know beans about piggyback riding.
My uncle, mother's brother, has 4 children, and I've seen them ride piggyback.
I bet there isn't a good piggyback rider in your whole family. I never knew a rich man yet who could piggyback ride.
You're prejudiced.
You show me a good piggybacker, and I'll show you a real human. Now, you take Abraham Lincoln, for instance, a natural-born piggybacker. Where do you get off of that stuffed shirt family of yours?
And go.
Okay, give me your initial thoughts.
Yeah, like I said, it's just a fun romp. It's one of these cases where the movie thrives and only lives off of the chemistry between the two actors.
Which works great. I mean, there was never a part of this movie like, oh, this is... It was just fun. And that's something that should be sneezed at when you have a movie that's just fun. I mean, that's not easy to do.
Yeah, yeah. I was doing a little bit not exhaustive reading on Frank Capra this weekend. And something one person brought out was that... Capra didn't spend a whole lot of time on pre-production. He wasn't a Hitchcock where he designed every camera angle. His focus was really on bringing out the performances of his actors and making sure the camera represented them well.
Which makes sense because, I've seen, I guess, 3 Capras, but It's Wonderful Life I love, but... Jimmy Stewart runs that show.
Yeah.
You know, and that's Capra knows how to make that happen.
Yeah, that is notable. You might think that sounds mundane, but when you have a director who is very really focusing on telling things with the camera, like his focus is on the photography and stuff, that can be neat. But there is, you're also asking your actors to jump through hoops a lot of times to really, the actors have to meet the needs of the camera rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
So it's a different choice. It's a different directing choice. And I think that's probably one reason why Capra is known, well, Capra-esque is kind of known for depicting the everyday man.
Yeah, because even this movie, there's a couple great everyman scenes. They're on the bus. They're just singing this song. It's just, you feel like they're 1934 just in this bus. Everyone's having a blast. And it's very natural blast. Not like one of these, like, sometimes at the end of a modern movie, they'll have everyone singing, dancing, and it's like, here's the capstone of the movie, be happy.
Uh-huh.
But it just feels like almost spontaneous. I mean, it's not spontaneous, but it has a little bit of that feel to it.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's not unusual for movies of this time to have a musical number, or even when it's not, musical numbers are not the main draw of the movie. Like
Marx Brothers had that.
Yeah, Marx Brothers did that. Even also in Abbott Costello movies, you would sometimes, they weren't singers themselves, but they would often have characters there who were really just to provide a song.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, it was expected, or it's like, it's part of the entertainment. Part of the entertainment. Yeah. Kind of part of the talky phenomenon, I think, a little bit. You know, music was such an important part of that aspect. It's like, oh, sound, we got to hear people sing. And sometimes it feels a little like forced in, those musical moments. But this wasn't. It was just people who are on a bus, you know, they're bored, and suddenly someone strikes up a band.
And everyone looks very normal. Everyone just looks like you just meet them in some small town somewhere.
I have to note, a cousin of mine was just telling me this about a week ago. She was on a flight home from Seattle, and she was like, okay, do you know the worst people to fly home with? Show choir people, because apparently it was late at night and they would not stop singing. She just wanted to sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
So people still do it, but be considerate of the time of night, folks.
And then there's some really snappy dialogue. I mean, some of the interactions between Peter and Ellie are great.
Yeah, Ellie is a fascinating character in some ways, because she is naive, she is a little spoiled, but she's not one note. It could be very easy to make a character like that one note.
In visual romantic comedy, sometimes that happens.
Yeah, but she can give back sarcastically as good as she gets.
I mean, and she escaped detectives. I mean, she's worldly wise in certain ways.
Yeah.
In narrow ways.
Yeah.
Like, she can hitchhike, she knows how that's going to work. It's not the... Man, Clark Gable doing his thumb routine, trying to hitchhike, was just great.
Do you mind if I try?
You? Don't make me laugh.
Oh, you're such a smart aleck. Nobody knows anything but you. I'll stop a car, and I won't use my thumb.
What are you going to do?
It's a system all my own.
Yeah, that is one of the most famous scenes of this movie. Him being all confident. Yeah, I'll show you how to hitchhike, and best ways to use his thumb, to no success. And then she just whips out her leg from her underneath her skirt, which might have been pretty racy in a day. It might be one reason why. I think if you see hitchhiking scenes where a woman attempts to do something scandalous, it's probably in thanks to this movie. I think this was a trendsetter.
And it's interesting because in some ways, very traditional rom-com.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, since it's 90 years old.
Yeah.
But also, it does some unique thing, you know, not like earth-shattering, but like, at first you hate the dad, and you're like, oh, the dad's actually pretty cool. And, you know, like, oh, this guy's hitchhike. He helped him hitchhike. He's so great. I'm like, oh, he stole their stuff. You know, it's like, there's little turns of...
It subverts your expectations occasionally. Like the dad, you think, oh man, he's just being super controlling. And eventually he's like, okay, no, just please come home. I'm so worried about you. Well, you can get married to this guy. And then later, when of course she's in love with this guy that she met on the road, he's like, are you sure you want to keep, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
And he becomes quite lovable by the end.
I don't know if there's a deep theme per se, but I guess you could, if you wanted to, throw that there is a sense of like, people have multiples, you know, there's almost like two sides to everybody. Like, there's the, what's his name that tries to hit on her?
Oh, the guy Shapley. In the bus. Yeah, yeah.
He seems like a goon, and then later on you feel bad for him. You know, the editor seems like he's hard-nosed, and he's like, hey, you come see me later. I mean, there's like, it's like everyone has like their public persona and their other one. I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, that's,
you know,
there's a
version you have where the curtains are up and the one, no.
Well, we'll go to that in a second. But that's something I had not pulled out of it.
I mean, it's relatively subtle. I think there's enough of that you can make that argument.
I mean, I guess you could say that's some Capra-esque peeking through. I mean, granted, he worked with a writer. He had a writer that he collaborated with.
Oh, so he collaborated with a writer. It's not like he took a writer.
I think so. I haven't read too deeply on that. But, I mean, it does feel like that sort of like deep down this inner goodness of people.
Yeah,
like with the father or the editor, yeah. But we should talk about one of the other famous things, but this... It is borderline racy, except not exactly racy.
Like, it's very upright, except it hints at, I mean, it like leaves that, there's the sexual tension.
Yeah, because they have to share a hotel room, and they're posing as husband and wife, but they're not. And so he hangs this curtain in between their two beds, and calls it the Tower of Jericho.
The Wall of Jericho, yeah.
The Wall of Jericho. And says, all right, nothing passes this. And,
yep. And he's not double. I mean, he's playing with her a little bit, but he's honest. It's not like he's not playing a game with her in that way.
Right.
I mean, he's a stand-up guy in many ways.
Yeah.
Behold the walls of Jericho. Maybe not as thick as the ones that Joshua blew down with his trumpet, but a lot safer. You see, I have no trumpet. Now, just to show you my heart's in the right place, I'll give you my best pair of pajamas. Do you mind joining the Israelites? You don't want to join the Israelites? All right. Perhaps you're interested in how a man undresses. You know, there's a funny thing about that. Quite a study in psychology. No two men do it alike. You know, I have a method all my own. If you'll notice, the coat came first, then the tie, then the shirt. Now, according to Hoyle, after that, the pants should be next. There's where I'm different. I go for the shoes next. First the right, then the left. After that, it's every man for himself.
It reminds me of something a professor at Taylor once said, how modesty is actually very sexy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the tease, it's the hidden, like, they know just on the other side of that curtain, she's changing clothes right now. Just that knowledge is enticing enough without actually having to see anything. And I don't know if they would have gotten away with this stuff in the postcode era, but at the same time, the whole movie is still pretty tame.
It seems to me it's a good sexual tension, not like a flirtation. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's something. It never came off to me like 42nd Street did.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It always seemed like it's building this honest romance between these two people. And maybe, I don't know. I don't know if that's how it's filmed or just one person's opinion.
I don't know, but I feel like it works.
Yeah, it does. It does.
I will note, just because anyone who talked about It Happened One Night's mentioned this, I feel like there's an urban legend that apparently after this, after people saw Clark Gable take off his shirt and he was not wearing an undershirt, sales of men's undershirts suddenly plummeted. and apparently it's kind of hard to prove that one way or another. Some people doubt that it's the case, but it's one of those things that it sounds possible.
Yeah. It does sound possible.
A similar urban legend, and actually some of the creators of Bugs Bunny have said that they got some inspiration for him because of this movie.
Yeah, the carrots and the...
Because of him, Clark Gable eating carrot and talking sardonically, and I guess...
I thought that, actually, as a watch. I'm like, oh, that's kind of Bugs Bunny-ish, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you think about it, like that scene where he scares off the other guy on the bus, like pretending to be a gangster.
Which is a great scene.
It feels kind of Looney Tunes-ish, though, you know, like the way it bugs off and outsmarts the...
It's funny because it starts off as sort of just like a Roman count, and everyone's like, oh, wait, this is screwball. Like, there's some weird stuff that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
Not weird, but just a little more extreme than I was expecting.
Yeah, more extreme than you would do a 90s thing. What was it about screwball? We talked briefly about the different genres, romantic comedy last season. Screwball is just a little bit more, the emphasis is more on ridiculous situations than like the 90s version of romantic comedy is.
Yeah, but the whole thing about eat your carrot, you know, like they have no gas, they have no money, everything is stolen. They're just trying desperately to get
to keep home. Moving. Yeah. Avoid the swarms of detectives who are on the lookout for her. So, yeah, I think this would be a very fun movie. I think, should we go ahead and talk about recommendations?
Yeah, let's do that, yep.
So, I think anyone who enjoys a good romantic comedy, I think you'll be able to feel
great.
Right at home here.
Yeah, and it's clean. I mean, not...
Yeah, it's a pre-code movie, so, like, But by today's standards, I think you're safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And honestly, after the end, after they actually do, spoiler alert, yeah, they actually do get married, husband and wife are only going to laugh at the business they have with trumpets and the walls of Jericho.
Yeah.
It's cute stuff.
It's just a fun movie. Watch it. You're laughing and you're just finding it. It's just very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, if a movie can be enjoyable, you've won.
And it goes to show that these were two actors who were at the top of their game. Even if they didn't want to be there, they wound up putting in the work and made something happen out of it.
Yeah. It happened one night. Yeah.
It happened one night.
We don't even know what the title is rolling.
I don't
about.
Know what the title is. That's not even, it's based on or inspired by a short story, but the short story is called Night Bus or something like that.
So
It's like, what happened one night? Which night? There were like three nights involved here.
One of those nights, it happened. They fell in love.
Something happened. It happened. Yeah. Which I will say, some of the nighttime shots are pretty well lit. But that is our time.
All right. Well, so far, we've had a strong season. At least an enjoyable season.
Yes, indeed.
Any last words? I think that's it until we introduce our next one, right?
Yes.
We'll be in 1944.
1944.
Watching.
This will be a movie that you have seen.
I have actually, yeah, for once.
I have not. Double Indemnity, which we talked about on our other podcast, Your Old Trains of Thought, way back in the day. If you want to get ahead of the game here and see what Nick and Brian Scherchel talked about that, go to our website, derailedtrainsofthought.com, search for Double Indemnity, and maybe you'll get a sneak peek of our conversation. We'll see what I think of this. I should have watched it way back when, but I did not. But we'll deal with that next time.
All right. I guess that's it for 1934. So until next time, this has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye-bye.